He's a drug addict. His dad was shot in the head when he was 6 years old. He was failing as a parent and probably as a husband. And now he has 45 doors, 205 more coming next week, doing great things on the relationship he has with his family and his children. A really incredible journey that sounds like a nosedive at first and then comes storming back to life, killing it in real estate as a family man, as a person. We're about to hear some incredible advice. Welcome to Real Estate Dads Podcast. And I am excited to have Frank DeBayas on here to tell you his story. Frank, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. So happy to be here.
So go into this. Your father was...
Yeah, so I'll give you this backstory real quick. So I grew up in the Bronx in New York City. My dad was an eye doctor and he was an entrepreneur. He was always driven with real estate. He had a passion to build medical offices in our community. At that time, it was in the Bronx. So his first deal, he had gone back and forth over a real estate transaction with the landlord. It went to court. He won. And instead of just letting it be, my dad, I guess, had an ego. He went to the guy to put it in his face that he won. You know, one thing led to another. My dad was a big dude. They got into a fight. My dad knocked him out. And as my dad was walking to his car, the guy ran up behind him and shot him in the back of the head. Now, that was on my 6th birthday. And I was waiting for him at a pizza parlor with my brother down the street from our house, right? And he never came. And, you know, it's crazy because I remember my getting picked up. And I don't remember much from 6, but I remember getting picked up by my uncle and going to the house and see like 100 people out there. And my brother, like, it's a birthday party. It's a surprise birthday party. And we got out and, you know, it wasn't a surprise birthday party. You know, my father was, he died instantly. You know, so that was how I got kind of the real estate and the dad thing. When you guys talk about that, is kind of crazy because my mom then took over the real estate and she kept us away from real estate because that was the scene of the crime where our father was murdered. And she kept us away from there. And she did the best she could. And then I got into real estate really in 2008 when, you know, life got lifey for her and she was over leveraging the properties. She was about to lose everything. And me and my sister in our early 20s were like, we got to get involved. So we got involved and essentially we went there and we turned it around. We sold the property and then we rolled it over into multifamily and then we kind of got off to the races. But there's such a connection between real estate and fatherhood for me that, you know, obviously I lost my dad and now being a dad, it's like I'm trying to do through real estate for my kids what my dad, I imagine, would try to do for us. But yeah, it's a tricky combination there, for lack of a better word.
What an opener for a podcast. My God. Wow. Okay, so there's so much to unpack here.
Yeah, that one hits pretty hard, man. I'm wondering like how you even coped with that initially, and it must have been, I can imagine, it must have been depressing for your mom to keep operating these real estate deals that her husband, that your dad had set up. Like, I can empathize with that. And then, oh, shoot, dude.
No, listen, I was 6, and I'm 44 now, so it's... Listen, my mom, she's a tough woman. She was 32. I can imagine having 3 kids, you know, and he didn't even have, the story goes, and I can't confirm this, but he had filled out all the paperwork for life insurance and sent in the check and he didn't sign it. And then they sent it back and he died. So she had nothing. And she paid off all her investors, all my father's investors. And she was a high school education, 3 kids, 32. I've barely got a grasp of things at 44. I can't imagine what it was like. Well, to answer your question, you know, I was young, but I became addicted to drugs and alcohol. That's kind of how I dealt with it. I lived a hard life in my 20s in New York City scene. I was in the restaurant world. Yeah, I lived fast and hard. And, you know, I lost a bunch of people close to me who, you know, didn't make it. They weren't able to succumb to what we were putting into our bodies. And it was only through sobriety, you know, through AA, that I was able to really get back into this real estate thing. One, but more importantly, be present and cognizant and there for my children, which was the most important thing. Now, you talk about being a dad. They say, you know, you have high lows and low lows. And that was as regards to AA. You know, a low low is maybe you live under a bridge and you're smoking crack. You know, a high low is kind of what I had, just like your rock bottom. Was I remember I was a happy drunk, but it was the next day. They called me Cranky Frankie. My daughter, who was 3 at the time, and she goes the next day, she goes, Daddy, you're scaring me. And to hear that from the girl that you're supposed to be like the pillar of safety, right? You're supposed to be that. This little 3-year-old, for her to come to me and say that to me, dude, right there, I knew I had to change. And I had to change, and I did change. And I went into AA And my life changed exponentially once I did. And it's through sobriety and, you know, I'm not going to get religious on you, but through my higher power, I was able to be there as a father. And not only that, I was able to pursue this thing in real estate, which, you know, I've made a lot of to-do lists over the years, but because of my addiction and things like that, I, you know, I always got in my own way. And now things are clear, guys. And it's just, you know, it's a beautiful thing when you're able to be there. The saying goes, be where your feet are. I'm able to be where my feet are and be able to be present. And, you know, I'm also able to chase these dreams that I had for a long time.
Wow. How long have you been sober?
Yeah, that's my question.
Just over 2 years. I've been in and out, but officially it's just over 2 years. So we took over our real estate portfolio in 2008, and we bought multifamilies in Harlem and Brooklyn, and then we went into northern New York, which is Hudson Valley, about 90 miles north of New York City. And it's grown, you know, it's grown. It grew organically while we were also doing a W-2. And when I say we, I mean my sister and I. She was a lawyer. I was a restaurateur. And I, you know, I dropped out of law school to because I read Kitchen Confidential and it was about doing drugs and living in New York City restaurant scene. And that sounded cool to me. That's what I wanted to do. Hey, Mom, I'm dropping out of law school. I'm going to go be a cook in New York City. And that's what I did. And while all doing that, we were still able to grow the portfolio. We grew the portfolio. We've been very fortunate in that regard. But now over the last 2 years, I found the world of syndication and it's getting kind of like pedal to the metal, focus, able to get things done, time management between the multiple jobs and things like that, that I would have never, ever, ever been able to do when I was using.
Wow. So this is a lot. So you chose 2008, you were in the real estate game then. And then 2 years ago is when you kind of feel like you kind of cut out these negative behaviors and went sober. Your daughter's 5 now.
No, I knew that I needed to change. I failed a couple of times at that point. My daughter's 8, but she was 3. So I was in and out of the rooms for a while. So in other words, I would relapse or, you know, I'd mess up, whatever. Yeah, I was. But that time happened when she was 3. So she's 8. So that was 5 years ago that happened.
And you're sober now for 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Me and my wife, Bull.
Well, congratulations on that.
Thanks, man. It is. Great.
Yeah, it is huge. You know, I've known people who have, I always have an admiration for people who pull themselves out of whatever that nosedive is for them. And I don't think that society always gives as much recognition as they should regarding those things, you know, because that's actually a pretty massive win. People don't really recognize how much of a win that really is to move away from those things and stay away. And then even when there's mistakes, still stay away, you know, because there's some people who just, they have a, what's the saying? You know, people decide when failure is. And, you know, failure, people choose that. You know, you can get back up or you can stay down. And when you stay down is when you've chosen failure. So I commit that you have not done that.
No, thank you. I appreciate it.
And how many kids do you have?
I have 2. So I have my son is 9 years old, Damien, and my daughter just turned 8. I have 2 amazing kids. Yeah, that's what it's all about. I mean, I think for me, I mean, we all talk about, we'll go on a million podcasts, we'll talk about the same thing, right? We're like, oh, you know, it's about creating freedom, you know, and time and freedom and get away things and get away from my W-2 and create generational wealth. But, you know, to me, it's, I don't know, that's all true, right? But it's also, I know it could disappear like this, you know, that whole thing could disappear. And I had a real complex and a real fear that I wasn't going to be there for my kids, that just like I didn't have a dad, these guys weren't going to have a dad. And that was real. That was a real fear of mine. And, you know, once I let go of that and I just take it for what it is, you know, one day at a time, it changes perspective. You know, one thing I learned, guys, is, and I don't know where there's a correlation here, but it's what's coming to top of mind right now, is I've tried to force the outcome so many times in my life. I've tried to force the outcome, whether it be with my own sobriety or what my life would have been like if my dad wasn't taken away from me. Or, you know, my son's here. I want to pull him over to the other side because he's not doing what other people or society thinks is the appropriate thing for him to do. Once I realized that I cannot force the outcome, you have to let go of that. All I could do as a father, all I could do as a husband, all I could do as a real estate entrepreneur is the next right thing. The next right thing that's in front of me. That's what we could control. We can't control anything else. We can't control whether or not we're going to get that deal. I can't control whether my son's going to be on the spectrum with ADD or if he's going to be a problem child. I just got to roll with it. I got to know that as a father, as a human being, all I could do is step up and do the next right thing. And once I stop trying to force the outcome, the amount of weight that is taken off your shoulders, it's tremendous. And you're like, okay, it's out of my hands. I'm turning, what we say is you turn your will over. I'm turning my will over. And that is something that I just tell people. I'm like, just do the next right thing. It's out of our hands. And, you know, I see people struggling, whether it's an addiction or people, you know, guys coming up in the, you know, sales world or trying to do the real estate thing and trying to force these things. And wow, if you fall short, you're a failure. Wow, if I fall short, you know, I can't believe that, you know, I'm not good enough for this. And, you know, it was just through trial and error that I've learned and through mentors, you know, AA sponsors and successful people that you just got to let go and just not force it. You can't control everything. You cannot control the outcome. As much as we want to, we cannot control the outcome.
Well, I would agree. And also just the sheer fact that if you're trying to control an outcome, it's probably pretty stressful when it doesn't occur, which I would imagine is a trigger because, you know, then there's this expectation of things going a certain way and they go another way. That's, you know, you just think it can be pretty stressful on the system.
So, gosh, there's so much interesting stuff in here. And if you want to talk about religious stuff, you are more than welcome. Just saying, you know, one great thing, or I mean, there's several great things about, Trevor and I both really enjoyed these interviews because we've gotten such a different perspective from different people who have been through many different walks of life. This is a pretty individual, and we don't have any other stories that are like this one that have been on the podcast yet. But, you know, what we found is that we know that we're not talking to someone who's actually the only person who's dealt with whatever it is that we've talked to. And we've had some pretty hairy stories. We have. We've had some ones that I'm just so shocked that, you know, people we knew for many years in some cases, you know, told us some things that we were just like, oh my God. But what that also lets us know is that there are other people out there we know who are experiencing things that our guests are able to let them know they're not alone on. And I am totally sure that we have listeners who have substance abuse issues and have experiences of things that they're, you know, going, hey, how do I, you know, separate from these behaviors? And, you know, and now we have an evidence of someone who's done that and has done that for their kids, has grown well with their real difficulties. So thank you for sharing.
Yeah, sure. I will say this about the God thing, and I don't go too much into it, but I had a God complex for the majority of my life. Because if there was a God, he's a real asshole because he took my father from me when I was six. You know, I had a stepbrother, whatever. I had a stepbrother who committed suicide when I was a kid. And there was a lot of issues that I had a God complex for. I really didn't open up to God. It wasn't through until sobriety that, you know, my sponsor, and it's something that you just said, you know, maybe they say God plays a long game. You know, I always created these situations in my head that if my dad was alive, I would have lived this lavish lifestyle. I wouldn't have been through the struggles that I went through, and everything would have been great. He says, you're living one scenario. You know, maybe God played the long game. From what I could tell from your father, he would say is he had an ego issue that, so much so that he won a real estate deal. Instead of leaving it alone, he had to go rub it in the guy's face rather than go seeing his kid at his birthday party. He wasn't the easiest husband around with my mother, I found out. You know, we put people on pedestals when they die, but through talking to my mother, he wasn't the best husband in regards to that. So maybe God's long plan was this. Maybe, perhaps, he sacrificed my father to save the rest of the family. Maybe, perhaps, by my dad dying, we were able to live a life that we did. Although it was challenging, maybe my dad would have abused my mother. Maybe my dad would have been, and me would have had a conflict of interest. And, you know, I would have been one of those miserable people who do what their father did, tells them to do, and went and did a life as a, you know, whatever, a lawyer or a doctor, and then being miserable about it. Once I accepted that, right? And, you know, my sponsor would say, Frank, don't open the door to God. You don't have to open the door right away. Just crack it open. Just crack it open to that possibility. And once I was open to that possibility, that maybe that was the long plan of God and he was actually looking out for me, is not the easiest thing to sit with. You know, I do miss my dad, but yeah, I think it makes it all a little bit more palatable to look at that. So through that, I was able to open up and turn things over to a higher power, like, you know, prayer and things like that. That stuff does work, whether or not, you know, whatever you want to call it, you know, affirmations, prayer, meditation. It does work, and, you know, just believing that there's something bigger than us, it certainly makes me take some stress off of my shoulders. I can only speak personally.
Yeah, I was religious for many years, and then I became somewhat atheistic, and then I became religious again years later. Not in the same way. You know, my faith didn't return to the way it was when I was, you know, young, you know, in college. And I think some of those things just changed as we get older. But yeah, but I'm a firm believer in more and higher power. And, you know, and the idea of what that higher power is, I often get a little upset with society in regards to them telling you what it is, because we don't really have a very good sense of that. But you know, a lot of people who dress up on stage with what they do. Sure, what were your thoughts?
You know, I practice faith in myself and in people these days. You know, I think faith runs the world. It does. It's the reason that we have this society that we have, is in large part because I believe that this piece of what we call paper, really a piece of cloth, if I take it and go to a place that has food, I can exchange it for that food. It happens every time, but until it has happened, you're acting on faith, and everything about our life is faith-based. The fact that I had faith that you two were going to show up to this meeting and we were going to get to talk about things, you know, like we're the only species that really plans about the future, right? Because it's not here, it's not real until it actually gets here, but we'll behave as if the future is true. And that's faith.
The bear does have faith that the fish will jump in his mouth on the river.
Well, there you go.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. It's a learned behavior.
How dangerous is it? How sometimes we think about, you know, that faith and our expectations of the future. Oh, man, that could be crippling in some regard, right? Is when we're too great. What's going to happen? Like, I got to tell myself just to slow down, dude, slow down. You know, we're the only species that get ahead of ourselves in that regard.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer that we're here to overcome challenges and obstacles, that our soul is eternally learning from overcoming challenges. And that every time we overcome an obstacle, it doesn't just stay with us in this life, it stays with us for permanence. And that's why I think that achievement is so important, is because it's this recognition of not just one that affects us in today's environment, but it affects us later also. This isn't a hard, fast, hey, this is how, you know, the afterlife is. But I believe that. I believe that our souls do go on. And I believe that, you know, when you have a overcome an obstacle, it's strengthening that soul for more of an eternal view.
I like that. I hope you're right. That sounds good to me.
Well, you know who says this kind of stuff? Actually, I shouldn't say who says this kind of stuff, but I'm an advocate of Bill Wilson.
Oh, there you go. I'm in.
The man. So Bill Wilson, Trevor, was a founder of AA.
Oh, founder of AA. Okay.
Founder of AA. And he was part of, I've never done LSD, but he was part of an early LSD study. They used to do these studies. There's a guy named Timothy Leary, and he was out in the 60s or 70s, and he was sending out samples of LSD to anyone who wanted to do research on LSD as a product. Apparently, Bill Wilson was a really severe alcoholic and drug abuser, and he was in one of these early studies. Though I don't know if it was a well documented study or how it went, but he went through one of these processes.
There's a whole documentary on what you're talking about. So yeah, you're right on with it. Keep going.
And he came out of it and he went, I don't want to be a drug user anymore. And he got together with some other guys and said, I want to create a program that helps people not do drugs and alcohol. And he, you know, within his experience had found a higher power. He found a higher power that said that, you know, there was more. And that higher power really gave a lot of people courage to have, gosh, I don't even call it faith to not use drugs or alcohol. But people forget how stressful life is. And a lot of drugs and alcohol, they tamper that stress response down. It makes it so people aren't concerned about those other things because they're medicating their mind. But if there's this recognition of there's more, and I don't need to be afraid, and I don't need to panic, and I don't need to try to control the future, and I don't need to do all these things, and that things, I just need to, you know, you said it in a separate sense, but you just have to make next best decision that comes up. You don't have to plan way into the future. You just have to keep making good decisions every day. Next decision. Make those decisions and make them good on every opportunity. But, you know, the philosophy on, you know, having challenges and overcoming them, I just think that's what we are called to do in life, you know, to not cower, not quit, to keep going through the journey, the obstacles, and coming up better and more confident on the backside of each one. You know, and that's why, you know, Frank, when I said, you know, I commend you for pulling yourself out of that nosedive, because a lot of people don't get it. You know, people who haven't had an addiction issue or haven't come from a place that you have, or haven't had a trauma where their dad was shot in the back of the head when they were six on the way to their birthday party as a kid. I mean, like, my God. Like, and people, they look at people who've got, you know, some of these addiction issues and they go, well, like, why can't they just get clean? And the reality is because it takes a massive magnitude of task. And pulling that nosedive and getting out of it takes, there's no one else does it. Like Frank, just saying, no one else did it but you. So when you're seeing that, like, I commend it because it's this recognition that, you know, you can do it. And a lot of people aren't able to.
Well, thank you for that. And, you know, I think You know, I'm really hesitant at times to tell my story, and I'm talking like in the rooms, but if it helps someone, but that's my story. Like, that's all I know. I mean, you're like, oh, it's tragic. I don't know. I mean, that's what I lived. That was my experience. But, you know, I think to your point, a lot of it also has to do with, oh, I lost my train of thought. That is my story. And essentially, I don't know any better. And I think to go back to where my children are, I mean, oh, I got it. I was going to talk about breaking the cycle of addiction. It's definitely hereditary in some regards, but also if you do remove, like you said, it's self-medicating, it's like a Band-Aid. There's definitely an underlying trauma or an issue involved with it. I think we all have it in some degree, right? And when you remove the alcohol or the drugs or whatever it may be, if it's work or, you know, some people sex, gambling, whatever, or whatever it may be, and you actually have to sit with it, sit with that discomfort, that gets real, man. That's heavy. And, you know, you're not going to, there's no escape, you know, there's no escape through the drugs or whatever. And I think for me, I wanted to sit with it because I wanted to show my kids that you can get through this, that you can break the cycle. You know, my worst fear as an adult is that my kids would kind of go through what I went through, right? And with that, I really like it. I'm not even talking about losing a parent. I'm just talking about all the bad decisions I've made. Like, all the bad decisions I've made. I mean, it's like, what? What are you doing? Like, I've made so many really bad decisions. But also to come out on top and now look at it and be like, damn, you know, I did really good. I'm okay. I survived that. I had to be doing something right, guys. I had to be doing something right because, you know, so many people are like, you don't get to where you are after going through what you went through. You know, like, we're not supposed to be like this. Take all the real estate, take everything out of the equation. For me, and it sounds cheesy, but it's just about being a good dad. That's all I freaking care about, man. I want to set these guys up for success the best I can. And truly, I can't guarantee they're going to be all right, but I just want to make sure that I'm present enough and available, especially during this period of time when they're young like this, because so much goes on with, you know, people, parents who are just there, but they're not there. And, you know, it just has such a detrimental effect on people, on kids.
So what are you doing now, Frank, to, you know, what are you, let's dive in. What are you doing now with your kids to set them up for success? Like, what does your normal day with them look like?
You know, man, I wish I had the answer for that. We're really trying. I'll be completely honest with you. It hasn't been easy. It hasn't been easy, you know, to throw some situations at you. Me and my wife have both got sober. So there's a whole relationship there. It's like we're a new couple. We're getting to know each other now as two sober people. Not saying we knew each other a long time. We had help, a nanny help, and that all disappeared. You know, there's a 1% problem, I understand. We had an au pair, didn't work out, our fourth one. She went back, so we had no childcare. I have my son's on a spectrum. He's amazing, and you know, but he's on a spectrum. And then I'm already thinking like, oh man, I gave this kid all his issues, you know, because we got mental issues running through us rampantly. But what are we doing? We try to have conversations with these guys. I don't, you know, at first I would dismiss feelings. I remember that. Like, hey, no, what do you mean you're scared? You're not scared. Come on, don't be scared. Like, I'm honoring their feelings. I'm letting them have the stage to actually express themselves. I'm listening. I'll tell you guys, I'd lie to you if I told you I didn't compare my kids to other kids. I did. And I was like, wow, my guy's not an athlete, or, you know, why, you know, my daughter's not able to do that. And that, I don't have a professional athlete in me, you know, then it's not going to happen. Why am I comparing my kids to other kids, right? That's a reflection of me. So what I've done is I've kind of, we've removed that. We've made a conscious effort to create an environment for these guys where it's safe to express themselves. If they don't like doing something, you know, we want to see them see it through. But we're not going to force our hand on anything. We really are not. What am I doing? I'm just being available. I'm getting home. When I'm home, my phone's down. I'm with the kids. I do daddy time every day. It's daddy Damien time, daddy Rosie time. Even if it's 5 minutes a day, we make sure we get that time. You know, we asked them the other day, which was funny. I asked them to give me a report card on what I could do better. Be just a dangerous thing to ask. Say, hey, what's daddy doing? Wow. My daughter was like, she broke her pen out. She's like, well, hold on, let me tell you. You might want to sit down for this one. No, all seriousness, I don't have the crystal ball. I don't. And what I do is I'm just trying to be available. You know, my wife had a very hard childhood with her mother, you know, kind of like instilling things on her, or, you know, it was all about image. We're not pushing that. You know, I live in a bubble. I don't know where you guys are. I'm in Connecticut in a bubble. And, you know, we're surrounded by a bunch of people who, you know, it's all about keeping up with the Joneses here. And we try to make sure that our kids are grounded enough to not fall into that trap.
You know, and what I hear within a lot of this, which is what I really like hearing, is that, you know, none of us have an answer. On a side note, just so you're aware, you know, the when we ask that question, we have not had anyone who goes, this is the answer.
I've got to figure it out, guys. Get your pens out. No one.
But, you know, but what I like hearing is that, you know, it's a very active role of listening and working to improve. You know, and that, because everything you said, you know, what I liked hearing about that is just, you know, hey, I want to hear how we can improve. I want to hear how we can do better, how, you know, whatever it is that's, that you are doing with them is also based in kind of an improvement. You know, you want to help them. You want to do everything you need to. Because I would say if you said nothing, you know, what do you do with your kids? And you, I don't know. They go to school. You know, that would be the problem. But instead, you
that would be parenting in the 50s.
Yeah. Well, you know, right. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, you know, thanks for saying that. And I think, you know, you guys already, you know, you're in the same. The fact that you're doing a podcast about parenting speaks to the kind of fathers you are. I would say this. One thing that I've also I've learned that when you screw up, take ownership. And it's like, you know what? Daddy screwed up. You know, I made a mistake there. The way I handled that wasn't the best. I'm trying to, and I'm not perfect. But I really don't think that was fair to you, the way I handled that. You know, rather than just ignoring it and pushing it aside like it didn't happen. You'll be surprised. I mean, you can see those aha moments in their face when you do that. And it also shows them that you could be vulnerable and it's okay to make mistakes, right? So I think being vulnerable, damn, that's what it is. It's being vulnerable and stop putting up this front. Yes, we're parents and we have to maintain a level of stability, right? We have to be there to keep them safe, but we also have to be there to show them that it's okay to put down your guard and screw up. And apologize, you know, because we're not perfect, man. And I don't know whether it's the school or whatever, you know, preconceived notions, you know, you get a bad grade, you're a bad kid. No, I don't care. As long as you tried hard, you know, did you really put forth an effort? Did you care? Okay, it's all good. That's to me, I think, being vulnerable. And I've learned, if I told you guys how much therapy we're in, you'd be like, Jesus, that's a whole nother podcast. But the whole family's in therapy, but it's good. You know, we have couple therapy, regular therapy. But I think it's good because, you know, it's also just us putting ourselves out there and, you know, not saying that we rely exclusively on therapists to help out. But, you know, you do take tidbits from everyone in every situation that could be beneficial to you. So, you know, I think I remember, you know, one of the therapists said, you know, just own up when you screw up. And that's been super helpful for us.
Frank, you mentioned that you went through four pairs, right? Four? You went one a year. I mean, what's the story there? Was that like you just tried a new one out every year? Is that how the program works? I mean, talk to us about au pairs.
They couldn't wait to leave. No, the program works. So usually they're on a visa, a traveling visa. And, you know, we just happened to, it's a two-year visa. We caught all of them on their second year and it just happened to rotate that way. Except for the last one who left unexpectedly. And then that was kind of, it all kind of snowballed and that all happened at the same time with regards to, there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of moving parts.
For those that are listening that are like, what the heck are you guys talking about? An au pair is basically someone from another country that comes and lives with you, gets a small weekly stipend and is essentially responsible for taking care of your kids when you're working, right?
That's what an au pair is versus a nanny. Like that's the term for au pair, is that they're foreign and they get,
I'm just learning something brand new.
They live in your house and it's like a kid, it's a student, and it's like, I don't know, you pay like a fraction of what you would pay a nanny. And the trade-off is they live in your house and you have to, you know, provide them with food and stuff. But, you know, we paid like $180 a week versus paying whatever you were paying a nanny, which is crazy. But you know, you also have to keep in mind it is a 20-year-old who's coming to the United States to experience life as a 20-year-old. So you have to keep that in perspective. If you get a solid C plus, that's good.
Yeah, that's good.
With regards to taking care of the kids, shoot for like a solid C plus.
I imagine there's some conflicts there, like they want to go out and explore or something, right?
Yeah, so totally, that's it. I mean, I'm right outside of New York City, so I mean, that was part of the draw was to get them here. But yeah, that's part of it, right? So that's kind of the balancing act. And now our kids are old enough that we just have somebody that comes a couple times a week when we're unable to be here with work. But yeah, you know, who knows, guys? I know there's been we're all doing the best we can, right? We're just, as long as we show up, right? And you know, my mom, after my dad died, she did great. And then she had her own addiction problems and, you know, she had some issues with, you know, a lot of things. But She always showed up, for better or for worse. She always showed up. And I think there's something to be said about that. Just showing up. Just showing your kids that, you know what, we'll be there. Whether it's showing up at the bus stop for a dance recital or just showing up at the side of their bed when they're having a bad day and just being available. To me, that's something that I think is more important than what you're going to learn in school or anything like that. I mean, those are the big lessons for me. Knowing that I had somebody there, and it wasn't my dad, it was my mom who just showed up. You know, there's such comfort and security in that. And that's what I want to, you know, I want to make sure I'm there. And that's another reason why I didn't want to go down, continue down a road with alcohol. It's just, you know, it's not worth it for me.
Well, yeah, that's my rule with anything. Is it worth it? And it used to be, you know, for alcohol, you know, if we were going out for a dinner with my wife, you know, for a lot, I mean, I didn't drink for years and now I'm not sober per se, but, you know, it would be if we had an anniversary, I might drink a little bit. And, you know, and now generally, to be honest, it's just, I just find that the benefit, the cost benefit for me is just outweighs, you know, and it's funny because even when you're talking about you and your wife kind of getting to know each other, oh man, I can relate. Not as much as you, but I get it. You know, when we're in this, I'll call it dating phase, and you know, and we're all living fancy free and we're traveling and, you know, there's a lot of partying going on. And then, you know, you end up in a parent role where you're responsible. You're not partying. You're staying domestic. You're going to bed early. You're getting up early. There isn't this, you know, kind of social life that has a lot of drinking, you know, potentially drugs, you know, involved around it, you know, and all of a sudden you're going, wait a minute, I'm with this person and those other things are not there. And yeah, no, I can understand that for sure. It's definitely it. And I think that's also one thing where I think it's just life changes in general, where I just recognize our lives just are continually changing. You know, two things you said, you know, and I do want to go into your real estate background here, but, you know, recognizing faults, I actually am a big advocate of, because it's the only way that people can actually improve. There have been people who I've made decisions whether I don't want to work with them or not, if they're able to recognize fault, because if they can't recognize fault and they can't fix the issue, you know, they're not actually identifying, then they can't even change to begin with or make an improvement. And, you know, and as far as therapy goes, you know, a lot of us didn't get good lessons from our parents. You had half the number of parents that most people had, you know, and your mom was busy, you know, and dealing with everything she was, you know, and with therapy, you know, there's a lot of lessons that, you know, some of us, you know, seek out in regards to wanting to get help or advice. So I'm glad that you did that. And I'm going to change over to real estate. Trevor, do you have any more conversations on this piece before I go over the real estate side?
No, let's dive into some real estate stuff.
So Frank, so tell us about, so you started in 08. How big of a portfolio do you have now?
So I started in 08. Right now we have 5 properties in New York City and we have 3 properties in the Hudson Valley. It's a total of 45 units, but then I'm also a co-GP on 53 units in Vermont and about to close on my first, knock on wood, 205 units in Nashville, Tennessee, which we are actually, it's a co-GP as well. And it's exciting. It's exciting. It's great, but it's been a learning. It's a learning curve for sure. But yeah, that's where we're at right now. So I don't have an exact number for you. Yeah. The ones in New York City with me and my sister, those are ours. We own them. And then the others are all syndications.
Are you full time, Frank? Or are you still work in restaurants?
No, I'm in the wine business, you know, the alcoholic who sells wine. Yeah, so I'm in the import distribution business in New York City. So yeah, I do that, which is great. It's kind of like I make my own schedule. It's mostly, you know, higher end restaurants and stuff in Manhattan. So it's very it's great. But yeah, I still do that for now.
So are you a rep? You're like a rep for wine? You sell wine?
Yep, exactly. Yep.
Oh, cool.
Now, we'll tell you with regards to real estate, if I may. Yeah, I would sell this to anyone. Like, don't force the hand because I was best and final. So at 88 units in Indiana. And, you know, I got the contract and I couldn't get a KP on it. And, you know, I was really forcing the hand and I wanted the deal more than anything. And then I think the realization for me, and this was just before this Nashville deal, was just being okay not getting that deal. Because I just wanted the deal, but the numbers didn't make sense. I had it at it was probably about $250,000 more than people wanted to invest in. And then I found this guy who has, you know, just shy of 1,000 units in Indianapolis. And he's like, dude, it's not the deal. It doesn't make sense. The numbers aren't making sense. He's like, I'll KP with you if it was X amount of dollars shorter. So I think the takeaway here for me was it's so important to just align yourselves with people who are where you want to be in real estate and who have been down there. And that's exactly what I'm doing with this Nashville deal. And the fact that now I have, through that loss, this gentleman and his group that are, we're looking at a couple of deals in Indiana. And then I also have the same like counterpart in Nashville. And I would just urge people to just take the time to find somebody to help you out instead of trying doing everything yourself, at least in the beginning. It's so helpful. Because I would have lost it all for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, no, I'm an advocate of you know, coaching, learning from others, you know, and I think that, I don't want to say it's something where people have been through therapy, but, or maybe it is, but, you know, I mean, finding mentors, people who know more, you know, I've always looked for those people. And it's good that you recommend that too.
Yeah, that's great. So, yeah, you know, this is an exciting time right now. You know, we're getting close with this deal. It's a Class C asset in Nashville. It's a distressed situation. And, you know, this is a deal that we got access to that hasn't even been to market. So, again, that's another thing I think is really important. When you align yourself with people that have a footprint in these markets, they're getting these deals that aren't even hitting the market, right? These guys have 500 units in Nashville. These guys, it's a distressed situation where the seller bought 30,000 units in 2020 and 21. And they're just going to have to unload anything that they've owned for more than 2 years to try and pay off the bridge loans that are coming down, the ones that they took loans out on in 2021. So it's a great opportunity. We're super excited. We're getting really close. By this time next week, it should be all fully subscribed. I'm excited in that I think my superpower for these deals is raising the capital. I've been pretty fortunate with regards to that. And I'm really focused on aligning myself with key players who have systems in place in Indiana and Nashville. Those are great markets for us.
Frank, I know it's slightly off topic, but incidentally, I have a friend who just moved to Las Vegas where I'm at, and he's selling tequila, and he worked in the warehouse for 7 years of this tequila producer. For several reasons, he moved out here to Las Vegas and took on a sales role. He's their first rep here in Las Vegas, and it's his first sales job ever. I don't want to say he has no clue what he's doing, but it's definitely his first time, and the only advice he got from the owners of the business, all he keeps saying is go visit the mom and pop stores. That's it. Do your route, go visit the mom and pop. So that's all he's doing. And what advice would you give him?
That's great advice from those guys. Yeah. Wow. Very sound advice. I would say this. I mean, this is something I tell a lot of the guys. I've been very fortunate in this regard. And I was in the restaurant industry before for 20 years. And then sales. The tequila is probably about 90% the same, right? You have, you know, maybe the top 10% or the top 2% of tequila that's really different from the rest of it. And that's with wine as well, right? It's all the same stuff. It's grapes, right? But there's only a small percentage that's really, you know, prestigious wine that is. Don't try to sell the tequila. That's what I would tell him. Learn about the individuals. And that's what I tell people. Start having conversations with these people. Get something that you can relate to them about. They're not going to buy the tequila necessarily because the tequila is so good. They're going to buy the tequila because they like you and because you bring something to the table for them. For me, I've been very successful in sales. It's not because my wine is fantastic. It's because I'm relatable to them. I was in the restaurant industry for 20 years. I could talk restaurant lingo with them. I could also find out, and I'll remember, I'm very good at saying, oh, you like golf? Okay, when I go in there, I don't talk about golf or their kids. I always ask questions that are outside the realm of the industry, right? What if I was to go into a store like that, I'd be like, wow, this is a great layout. This is amazing. Do you guys do in-store tastings? I'd love to come in here and pour some tequila for some of your customers that come in. And then through that time, I would use that as an opportunity to kind of dig into them and learn about them. So what I always tell people is, in New York City, there's over 135 or something wine companies trying to sell wine to these restaurants. And why are they going to buy wine from you versus somebody else? And I think this is something in sales in general. It's because of you. You have to sell yourself. And it's not so much that you're selling yourself as something special. It's you're selling yourself in that you have the ability to listen and take in what other people need and want. There's something really to be said about that. When you got to think about it, there's so much value. And a lot of those people that are working in those stores, right? And in those restaurants, they're not making a lot of money. They're barely getting by, right? What they want is somebody that's going to come in and make them feel better for, you know, those 15 to 20 minutes. And that's what I do. I come in, I'm talking about you. I'm talking about how good you look. You look great. You know, I'm always the guy like, here he is. Look at this handsome devil. And then, you know, it's little things like that. And it's remembering what they tell you, the bits and pieces of information, storing that and having it and bringing it back up next time. And I would say persistence is key. You know, if you just got to keep going in.
That gentleman is why Frank's superpower is raising money right there.
Real estate raising 101.
Yeah. It's important.
Thank you,
guys.
Man. Yeah.
But yeah, I'm excited. Listen, I love what you guys are doing. I do. To me, it was when I started the dad thing and the real estate thing. I was like, I got to get on this podcast. But I'm just super grateful for you guys. So thank you.
Yeah. You know, Frank, thanks for being so just honestly raw. You know, I really appreciate it because I think the people that aren't don't have as much to share, to be honest. You know, we end up, and every time, you know, we have these podcasts, there's always little things that go, should I say that thing about my own personal life? You know, and I go, I don't know. And then, you know, and every guest we have who does, I'm just like so thankful. I am every time because I just know how many people out there have, you know, similar experiences. I've known tons of people over the course of my life who have had addiction issues. I had addiction issues, you know. I'm so glad I don't drink alcohol anymore. I was drinking like a fish in my entire 20s. So glad I don't anymore. You know, it's one of those things that, you know, when we have guests who are able to share and also have 45 units, 53 units in Vermont, another 203 in Nashville, 5 properties in New York, 3 in Hudson. I mean, like, it's great. You know, I love hearing these win stories, you know. It's just really awesome.
Thanks, guys.
So Frank, how do people get in contact with you?
You can contact me on damroassets.com. That's damroassets.com. And then on all social media, we're Damro Assets. So LinkedIn, Instagram are probably our two biggest.
Great. And we'll have a link to his contact information on our own website, therealestatedadspodcast.com, where you can see all of our episodes, in addition to getting access to our Slack channel, where you can present deals for investment and also see deals that other people have put together if you want to be an investor. And also, if you are a listener and you know of anyone who could be a great guest or you yourself could be a great guest, you've got a great story about fatherhood, your own personal experience in this life, and you work in real estate, contact us. There's a link on that website, and we'd love to speak with you. So thank you for listening, and we'll catch you on the next episode.